You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The holiday season is a time for eating with large family meals and plenty of cookies, pies, and treats. But for people with diabetes, it can be tough with temptation on every plate threatening to spike their blood sugar. Whether you have diabetes yourself or you're expecting a holiday guest with diabetes, many of us want to be considerate with our cooking this winter. Our next guest is here to help us tailor our menu and our recipes to help meet the needs of people with diabetes. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you or your family? How does diabetes affect your holiday cooking? Have you found ways to navigate holidays in particular? Or do you have a question for some strategies about not just the recipes and ingredients, but timing and things like that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jessica Ball is a registered dietitian and the nutrition editor for Eating Well. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I could see people, Jessica, going to two extremes if they have diabetes. One, well, it's the holidays. I'm going to take a break from those rules. Or I have diabetes and I don't get to enjoy the holiday at all. You've been writing and thinking about this a lot lately. There are ways to navigate safely through the holidays, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, I'll just say the holidays should be about focusing on enjoying time with your family and your loved ones and being grateful for the year that's passed rather than stressing about every bite of food that you take. So that's the perspective that we share at Eating Well for people with any health conditions, including diabetes. But that should be priority one. That said, there are a few simple strategies that can go a long way in helping you feel your best and align with your goals over the holidays. And so one of my favorites and the simplest is called the plate method. So this is when you're like looking at your plate, right? And no matter where you are, aim to try and fill half of it with like non-starchy vegetables. So these are like your green beans, kale, peppers, onions, whatever you have at your gathering. Having a remaining quarter of the plate for higher protein, like satisfying foods like turkey or ham, and then leaving the last quarter for sources of carbohydrate. So this would be like whole grains or starchy vegetables like winter squash and potatoes. I would even put stuffing in this category because of the bread that it contains. So this method is super easy. It's super fast and it can be done anywhere without meticulous counting. So that's one of the main strategies. If you take one thing away from this, if you have diabetes, that should be it.
Now, before we even get to the meal, a lot of times these big gatherings will involve snacks. Now, with people with blood sugar problems, diabetes, and others, timing of food and what they eat can be super important. Can you talk about some snack strategies, especially, you know, the turkey's taken longer than we expect. We've all been at that gathering, I think. Can you talk about that pre-meal countdown and how people can deal with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, I'll say that diabetes is such an individual disease, and everyone's blood sugar levels and their response to food can be really individual. So always check with your healthcare team and your doctor about specific strategies for you, especially if there's any like insulin injections or blood sugar lowering medications involved. But when you're thinking about snacks and ways to like keep a steadier blood sugar level throughout the whole holiday, check in with the host if you're not hosting and see what snacks, if any, that they're planning to serve before dinner, just in case, like you mentioned, things take a little longer than expected. This can help you plan accordingly, but also is a great opportunity for you to offer to bring something that you know will help keep your blood sugar levels more stable, whether that's like a veggie crudite or like a fiber-packed dip like a hummus with some whole grain crackers. Yeah, lots of great options.
Now, for that host, what kind of recommendations do you have for, maybe this is more on the social side of things, but talking to their guests, maybe that person they know has a blood sugar issue, and coordinating with them to make sure that, you know, at least 80% of the meal is going to be friendly to everybody?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think transparency and just communicating with each other, that's key, right? Because like I said, diabetes and any like blood sugar related illness is really individual. So if you're hosting and you know someone has special considerations, whether it's diabetes or even like a food allergy, just ask, how can I best make this enjoyable for you too? Is there anything that I should consider? When we think about diabetes, there's two main things to consider, two main nutrients to consider. So carbohydrates, particularly simple carbohydrates. So those are things that burn up more quickly, like your added sugars, and also saturated fats. So an easy way to limit added sugars is just by reducing the amount of sweetener or sugar that's added to foods, particularly dessert, or considering what toppings am I adding to things like sweet potatoes that are already naturally quite sweet, and opting for things like fruit that are naturally sweet that can meet that craving in a way that better aligns with their goals and has some fiber. And for saturated fat, it's best to just enjoy smaller portions of like the creamy or cheesy foods or things like gravy. And also, if you're open to it, opting for reduced or like non-fat dairy and cheese options for lowering the saturated fat a bit.
You said a couple magic words that I keyed in on there. Sweet potatoes, Jessica. We also call them yams sometimes. I love them. I don't like when people put, you know, the marshmallows and sweet stuff. I like them as a savory food. And I've heard anyway, and correct me if I'm wrong, that compared to potatoes, they can be a little better on glycemic indexes and things like that. Is a sweet potato a good strategy for cooking for the holidays with blood sugar in mind?
I think that a sweet potato can be a great option for people if they enjoy it and are, you know, it's a classic for a reason, right? If they're delicious. And like I said, they are sweet naturally. Mm-hmm. That's obviously the natural sugars in the potato itself. But they also contain a lot of fiber. They contain a lot of vitamins, beta carotene being one. But yeah, they're a great wholesome option. And again, just being mindful of the toppings, I think that any food that has fiber, any of like the vegetables, even winter squash, is great for people who have diabetes, who are looking for something that's digested a little more slowly.
And preparation method for the sweet potatoes, I peel them, dice them, toss them in some oil and spices and roast them a little over 400 till they're starting to crystallize or a little bit, or caramelize. Sorry, that's the word I'm looking for. Do you have a favorite way to prepare and or eat sweet potatoes, Jessica?
Yeah, I'll share one from our recent spotlight that's newer to me, but totally delicious. So we interviewed Anthony Anderson, who's a celebrity who manages diabetes, and he shared his sweet potato home fries with cranberry and hazelnut crumble. Absolutely delicious, like all the Thanksgiving flavors in one bite. And kind of similar to what you said, they're cubed, they're sauteed up, so they're a little bit browned, they're delicious.
Jessica Ball is with us, registered dietitian and nutrition editor for Eating Well. We're talking about diabetes-friendly holiday cooking and meal planning, and not just sweet potatoes. Sorry about that detour. I love sweet potatoes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about your life, your holiday planning over the next handful of days? Join in now at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your strategies, or your questions for Jessica. That's 800-642-1234. All right, let's talk about desserts. We've got a recipe that we'll talk about in just a minute. But in general, I mean, obviously, we think of desserts as super sweet and sugary. Are there approaches to dessert that can be a little more diabetic friendly?
Yeah, so there are a few things that I look for in a really great holiday dessert, whether or not you have diabetes. And one of those would be make ahead. So we took some care to have, I think the recipe that we shared with you, but a lot of recipes in our spotlight have the ability to be made in advance to save you some time and precious oven space on the day of, just give you a little flexibility. But all of our recipes, including the desserts, were designed with our diabetes-friendly nutrition parameters. So we're obviously a nutrition wellness brand. We have a bunch of different nutrition parameters. And for diabetes, this means recipes are mindful of carbohydrates and low in added sugars. They limit saturated fat and sodium, and they rely on things like fruits, nuts, and seeds or nut butters and spices for something that's really delicious, but can help align with people's goals who have diabetes. And, you know, with options like our cranberry crumble bars or our peppermint chocolate tart, like what more can I say? They are delicious.
And that's one of the ones you shared with us. That's the one you shared with us, the peppermint chocolate tart. We've got that up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Ends up being lower than we might think in sugar. Can you talk us through that recipe a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. So tarts are obviously like beautiful, eye-catching, the little peppermint candy crumble on top is like really show-stopping. I think it would be also great for Christmas as well as Thanksgiving or whatever holidays that you celebrate this season. But it's super simple. You make a simple crust. We include whole wheat flour in the crust and some cinnamon for a little fiber and some anti-inflammatory benefits. You bake that alone, and then you make the tart filling which includes, you know, dark chocolate. Chocolate is another powerful anti-inflammatory, actually. Just we opt for dark chocolate because it's lower in the added sugars. And peppermint extract for some delicious flavor. It's sweetened with things like honey, which we still consider a source of added sugar, but it is more flavorful and is still low in added sugar compared to standard desserts. So once the crust is cooled, you swirl together the filling, add it, let it set, and then sprinkle on top with some crushed peppermint candies if you desire. It's really delicious.
We're talking to Jessica Bell, nutrition editor at Eating Well. You can find lots more dessert-related diabetic-friendly recipes there. Talking about holiday cooking for people with diabetes, whether you're the host or the guest, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Whether it's you or a loved one, what role does diabetes play in your holiday season? Are you cooking for someone with diabetes? Maybe you have it yourself. Have you consulted with a healthcare professional on trying to come up with good holiday meals that work well from a health standpoint as well? Have you found alternatives to some of the Thanksgiving favorites? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Jessica Ball, registered dietitian and nutrition editor for Eating Well. She's with us today to help us with our holiday cooking for people who have diabetes, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is diabetes part of your holiday meal planning? If you have it yourself or if you're cooking for those who do, love to hear your workarounds, your substitutions. Maybe you found something even better than the original. Or if you have questions for our guest, you need some advice and or inspiration, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jessica, I want to dig further into a point you made earlier. You know, this is kind of general advice. Everybody's diabetes experience may be different. There's type 1. There's type 2. Can you talk about all the different things people might have to factor in and maybe even think about talking to a healthcare provider about?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to briefly touch on for people who aren't as familiar, type 1 diabetes is a type of where your body does not produce insulin. Type 2 is where your body becomes less sensitive to insulin over time. And so people with type 2 diabetes might be able to intake insulin in another way to help manage their blood sugar levels, whereas people with type 1 diabetes might need to find alternate strategies or require insulin. And insulin is kind of like a lock and key. It allows blood sugar, so blood glucose, into your cells. It's how our cells get energy to do all the things that they do for us. And so I think some of the common symptoms can really vary, and there might be no symptoms related to things like pre-diabetes, which is when your blood sugar levels are more elevated, but not quite elevated enough to classify as diabetes. So if you're at all curious, talk to your healthcare provider. They can do a test called HbA1c. It's a hemoglobin A1c. That's like a 90-day average of your blood sugar levels to determine where you are and help determine a healthy range for you. But I can't stress enough, like everyone is different. Everyone's diabetes is different. Definitely talk to your healthcare professional like a doctor.
Now, a strategy I have after a big holiday meal and not related to diabetes at all is, gosh, I'm really full. Hey, everybody. Let's go for a walk. And you write, and you gave us some notes, exercise actually can play a big role in helping get through that holiday. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of my favorite fun facts, but we have covered some research studies about how even just walking for a few minutes, like anywhere from 2 minutes to 5 or 10 minutes, can almost immediately lower your blood sugar levels. So yeah, I think over the holidays, one great strategy is to find some movement every day. And this doesn't have to be complicated and it doesn't have to be long, but it could be something like a morning walk to, you know, get out, have some personal time before the madness of the day, or maybe something more organized like a family game or a local event like a turkey trot if you're feeling up to something like that. But I would also remind listeners that movement can compound throughout the day. So let's say after each meal, you go for a 5-minute walk, that's 15 minutes of movement at the end of the day that you might not have had otherwise. And it will definitely help impact healthy blood sugar levels.
Well, I think our caller Sandy in Madison has some thoughts on exercise. Sandy, hi.
Hi. Actually, she kind of took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say that for me, what really works is to just take a walk, and that would be before the meal, after the meal, or both. And that really seems to help.
And do you, for a holiday, Sandy, do you organize this as a group and or family activity, or do you just take off on your own for a bit?
Well, if somebody wants to go with me, that's fine. Otherwise, I just take my dog and go.
Excellent. Sandy, thank you so much for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Before and after the meal, she says, Jessica, she goes for that walk with dog and maybe with some of her dining companions.
Yeah, I love that. Like, it doesn't have to be complicated, right? It can be as simple as lacing up your shoes and just getting out the door for a few minutes.
Thanks again for sharing that call, Sandy, at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. Jessica Ball is with us, nutrition editor for Eating Well. We're talking about holiday or diabetes-friendly holiday meal planning. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jessica, you have some thoughts on, it's Thanksgiving coming up, on gratitude as we think about the food we eat and the holiday. Could you share some of your thoughts with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think for a lot of people, the holidays feel like a pretty natural time to, you know, to reflect on the previous year. And I think gratitude falls into that. So even though it's a little easier said than done, it's important to take some time, I think, to think about what you're grateful for, whether things feel like they're going really well, or maybe they feel like they aren't. And it might do more than benefit just your perspective alone. So we have found some research as well that shows practicing gratitude might benefit your physical health as well. It can help reduce your stress levels, help lower blood pressure, and actually help lower blood sugar levels. It can also help increase serotonin and dopamine. These are like the happy hormones, and promote overall well-being for your mental and physical health.
Now, for some families, alcohol might be part of the get-together. I know for some people with diabetes, that's probably just off the table. For those who can drink, though, what are some things they could do to make it a little more diabetes-friendly?
Yeah, for sure. Like you mentioned, it's a little complicated, alcohol and diabetes. So this is another, I feel like a broken record, but talk to your healthcare team about strategies that are good for you personally. But the general guidelines are no more than one drink a day for females and no more than two drink a day for males. So this, a standard drink is around 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of a distilled spirit like vodka or rum. So some ways to make that a little bit more diabetes friendly are to always consume alcohol with food and never drink on an empty stomach if you can avoid it, or when your blood glucose levels are low. So don't skip a meal if you know that you're going to be at an event where there might be some alcohol involved. And also, for if you are consuming a drink, try and avoid drinks that are lower in, or that are higher in alcohol content. So choose ones that are lower in alcohol content, and choose mixers that are lower in added sugar. So like seltzers or club sodas or 100% fruit juice that has no added sugar. Even diet soda might be a better option for your diabetes than a traditional soda, which is high in added sugar.
Now, Jessica, you mentioned earlier the actor Anthony Anderson. He collaborated with you at Eating Well on this on the diabetes-friendly holiday theme. And a part of the goal there is, I think, just to have more people talking about diabetes and being aware of it. How important a part of the story is that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we really loved working with Anthony. And one of the things that we loved about working with him is how real and forthcoming he was about living his life to the fullest, even with diabetes. And part of that is understanding that all foods can be part of a healthy diet. And you don't need to cut out the things that you love, either during the holidays or any time when you're diagnosed with diabetes. So that's the message that we convey to our readers at Eating Well each and every day. So it was great to hear that he was aligned with that. And it was really nice to have the opportunity to sit down with him. And actually, like I kind of alluded to earlier, we were able to publish a few of his personal recipes on our website. So you'll have to go to eatingwell.com to check those out. But yeah, really great that there are ways to enjoy yourself and be healthy when you have diabetes.
You mentioned the, I think it was sweet potato fries recipes. What are some of the other things we'll find? You mentioned also a couple of desserts. What are some of the other holiday recipes you're sharing on the diabetes theme?
Oh, there's so many, but I'll give you some of the highlights. The first that I am looking forward to making this year, our prosciutto wrapped pineapple bites. Mm. So this is like a little sweet and salty one bite appetizers. They're on a little toothpick, so perfect for like a appetizer or potluck spread. And this is where I mentioned like that leaning into the natural sources of sweetness, like fruits, can be just as satisfying. And this is a great example. We also have some 3-ingredient cranberry and brie bites that are baked in little like pre-made pie crust cups that are super delicious and crowd pleasing. We have a roasted beet salad for something more like a main. We already talked about our peppermint chocolate tart, but the last dessert that I'll call out that I think is really fun are our apple pie in an apple. So the crust, quote unquote, of the pie is like the apple itself. And then there's a little bit of pie crust on top. They're visually really great and they are lower in added sugar while still feeling really festive and classic.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Jessica, taking it back to the beginning, I think part of your hope here is that we don't add a lot of stress with our diabetes-friendly holiday cooking. Holidays can be stressful enough on their own. With a little advanced planning, though, it sounds like we can have things go pretty smoothly.
Yeah, definitely. I think planning is one key part of it, like checking in with people who are hosting, seeing if they can help accommodate with your needs if you have diabetes, or planning for the foods that you're preparing to make them in a way that's inherently more diabetes friendly. But I also think that strategies in the moment can be really helpful too, right? Because nothing goes according to plan, you know, least of all at the holidays. So things like I mentioned, that plate method where half your plate is vegetables, a quarter is proteins, and a quarter is carbs. It just helps you have a balanced meal just with a quick glance. No one even needs to know that you're thinking about it that way, but it can help you have a meal that's balanced and actually energizing and aligned with your goals.
Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jessica Ball is a registered dietitian and the nutrition editor for Eating Well. She's with us today to share advice and recipes for holiday cooking for loved ones with diabetes on this edition of Food Friday. Find one of those desserts we talked about over at WPR.org/Food Friday. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. People with student loans had to start paying them back again in October after the end of payment moratoriums started during the pandemic and after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled President Biden's loan forgiveness plan unconstitutional. The Biden administration has a new plan to help people pay off their federal student loans. The new plan is less expansive than the initial plan and would only help people in certain categories, not across the board. This new plan is also likely to be challenged in the courts, and even if everything goes smoothly, it would still be probably at least a year until it could be implemented. So what should borrowers do in the meantime? We're talking about the return of student loan payments and the possibility of some forgiveness on the horizon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did student loan payment moratoriums affect you? Did they change your financial situation over the last few years? How is the resumption of payments affecting you? What are your thoughts on different kinds of student loan forgiveness, the options on the table? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Betsy Mayotte is the president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors. Betsy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Before we get to this new Biden administration proposal, can you talk about the reinstatement of student loan payments and how that's been going nationwide so far?
Oh, boy. So this is a sort of an historical event in the world of student loans. We've never had a pause, never mind a 3.5-year pause. And then consequently, we've never had 40 million borrowers all reentering repayment at exactly the same time. Obviously, because of that high and sudden volume, people are experiencing some bumps in the road, such as very long call hold times sometimes, and some delays in processing, perhaps if they applied for a lower payment option. But I think the vast majority of borrowers have been able to ease back into repayment fairly pain-free.
A bit of advice here. If someone is hitting these repayments and realizing this is more than they can realistically fit into their current budget, are there options out there for them?
Yes. So thankfully, with federal student loans, there are quite a few different options. Excuse me,
That's okay.
such as lower payment options. There's multiples of those, as well as deferments and forbearances that will outright stop the payments. The Department of Education's website, which is studentaid.gov, is the best place to go to start researching what those different options are.
Now let's turn to the Biden administration's new plan. We saw, as I mentioned earlier, the U.S. Supreme Court nixed a previous version. This one seems more narrowly targeted. Can you talk about the scope, first of all, of what we're seeing from the White House?
Yeah, so I was pleased to see that President Biden is attempting to take a second bite at that sort of broad forgiveness apple. He's going about it in a very different way because of the result from the Supreme Court. And because we're still sort of in the beginning of this process, we don't know exactly what it's going to look like yet. But it appears, as you mentioned, that it won't be as broad as what his initial proposal was. It looks like the direction they're going in is to identify several sort of extreme factors that borrowers might be experiencing that's causing long-term hardship as a result of their student loan, and contemplating forgiving their loans if they fit several of those criteria. So for example, if someone has been paying on their loans for a significant amount of time, and maybe their balance is still what they started at, or even maybe even higher than what they started at, or maybe the borrower has a high balance and has been paying for quite a bit of time and they're elderly, and it's clear that they're not going to be able to work or increase their income. Maybe there's someone that maybe should have qualified for an existing discharge or forgiveness program, but because of some quirk, they weren't able to obtain that. That might be something else that they're looking at. I do want to point out, though, that regardless of what happens with this particular initiative, the Biden administration has already forgiven over $1.2 billion in federal student loans for well over $1 million under some other smaller initiatives that have been taking place over the last 3 or 4 years.
What kind of people, what kind of situations have people been in that has gotten them at least some level of forgiveness?
For example, there is an existing discharge for people that are totally and permanently disabled, but there was a real barrier within that discharge that caused people that were initially approved to have their loans kicked back in. So the White House got rid of that particular barrier. A broader example is with the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. There was a temporary waiver in place during part of the COVID period that allowed people who maybe weren't under the right repayment plan or had been given some misinformation in the past about PSLF to get past periods to count towards that forgiveness program that normally wouldn't count. They've done some great strides with a discharge program for people that were defrauded by their schools. And that was an initiative, that was a program that the prior administration was firmly against and did everything they could to roadblock it. And so this administration has opened that discharge process back up and provided relief to quite a few borrowers that were defrauded by their schools, such as there was a big story about Corinthian colleges, for example. And then there's a current initiative that's going on right now and will continue to go on through next year to give people credit towards forgiveness based on payment plans that are related to their income.
We're talking to Betsy Mayotte, president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors, looking at student loan debt, a new plan on offer in the early stages here from the Biden administration that would forgive a student debt in certain circumstances, and looking at the reinstatement of student loan payments after a fairly long moratorium because of the pandemic. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about your student loan debt situation or your kids? Do you have thoughts? Did you get a change in your monthly payments one way or another? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Betsy, as we've mentioned a couple times, this new Biden plan, the early stages here, what would have to happen between now and I don't whenever for these changes to come into effect?
So the process is called negotiated rulemaking. And the first step of that process is a series of meetings with affected parties to try to come to agreement of what the new regulation should look like. We're about to have the third in the series of three meetings. From there, the Department of Education will publish draft regulations, at which point anybody can comment on those draft regulations. Every single one of your listeners, you, me, your brother, your sister, your mother, the maybe not the dog, will have an opportunity to comment on those. And the Department of Education will review those comments and then issue the final version of those rules. Now, that process normally takes about a year, but it is my understanding, and I'm getting the sense, is that for this particular negotiated rulemaking, they're sort of putting it on the fast track. So while normally I wouldn't expect to see final rules before next November, I would be surprised if we didn't see them well before that, maybe as early as August or September.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Wausau. Jim, hi.
Hello. Great conversation. Thank you for having the guests on as well. I just got a general question. What changed over the years where the students needed forgiveness now in their student loans compared to, for instance, like in the 70s, late 70s and early 80s when I graduated and, you know, I had to pay that back? I other than COVID, did COVID just stretch everything out where all of a sudden the loan payments are due quicker, or what's the circumstance?
Jim, thanks for the call. Betsy, having been a college student in the 1980s and having kids in college now, tuitions are one big difference. Can you talk about what has changed in the intervening decades?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You're right. The first thing is that the cost of higher education has gone up dramatically, well beyond the general sort of cost of living increases over the years. The other thing that's happened, and one of the reasons for this, is that since the 70s, the states have drastically de-invested in higher education. So the cost of attending your state school or your local community college is much, much higher than it was back in the 70s or even the 80s, which means that more people have to take out student loans to be able to afford their college education. The average student loan debt today at the national level is about $37,000. And even 10 years ago, it was only around $23,000 or $25,000. The other thing we're seeing is it's taking people a lot longer to repay their student loans than it used to. The most recent data, which is not recent at all, is from 2012. And at that point, it was taking the average federal loan borrower about 15 years to repay their loans. And back in the 80s, it was taking an average of, I believe, and don't quote me on this last statistic, but I'm fairly certain it was only about 5 or 6 years to pay off student loan debt.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Carla is with us now in Fox Lake, Illinois. Carla, hi.
Hi. I've been paying off my daughter's student loan debt for over 10 years. And it's down to $13,000. My daughter doesn't works in the arts, will not make more than about $23,000 a year last year or this year. And I was told by someone from the agencies to just not pay anything, just don't even process and try and process anything. I'm wondering about the wisdom of doing that.
Carla, thanks for the call. Betsy?
That's a terrible idea. You know, right now we're in what's called an on-ramp period. It's something the Department of Ed set up to understanding that the repayment restart might be bumpy and to make sure that borrowers weren't harmed by those bumps. And during the on-ramp period, failure to pay your loans is not going to result in a negative reporting to your credit report, but interest is still going to accrue and you will still be considered delinquent. A much better solution for this caller's scenario is to have her daughter apply for what's called the SAVE plan. With that, with her daughter's income of $23,000, her payments will be zero under the SAVE plan. So, and the interest will be subsidized. So she won't be accruing interest as long as her payments are a $0 payment. And because her actual bill will be $0, she won't show delinquent. So there's all kinds of benefits to actually just getting on the save plan rather than just letting it ride and letting the loan go delinquent.
Thanks for that call, Carla. Good luck to you and your daughter. Deb joins us now in Waukesha. Deb, hi.
Oh, hi. Good evening. Yes, this is my question. Okay, I am going to be 70 in January. I had been on, of course, forbearance as everyone else, and I had been on the when I was working, because I worked until like I was 67. I was on the income driven repayment plan. But then once I retired, and even and I'm working just minimally part time, I had been dealing with Great Lakes, and they had said, "Well, frankly, you don't make enough, so you're going to be paying zero, I think, forever." Because if I had to start paying, you know, it wouldn't look good for me as far as my long-term viability. And so I've been on zero for during the forbearance, but also because of my lack of income coming in. But nonetheless, I have that debt that is still there. You know, when you do your credit, it's like, okay, your current debt load, credit cards, which is like I pay mine every month with the student loan, you know, is big. It's a lot. So I'm wondering, in my circumstance, is there any way we could just like get the eraser and erase it all?
Interesting. Deb, thanks for sharing that. Betsy.
Eventually, but not right now. So it sounds like you're still on an income-driven repayment plan, which is exactly what I would have recommended for you in your circumstance. Another benefit to those income-driven plans is they all have a baked-in forgiveness component, where if you're on the plan for either 20 or 25 years, and whether it's 20 or 25 depends on what kind of loan you have and what plan you're on, but if you still have a balance after you've been on those plans for that period of time, they will automatically forgive it. So you just have to sort of wait it out. Make sure you recertify your income and stay on the plan annually when they request it from you. And then eventually once you hit, sounds like you might have another either 10 or 15 years left, it will automatically be forgiven.
Deb, thanks a lot for the call. Betsy Mayotte is with us, president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors, talking with us about the Biden administration's new student loan forgiveness plan and the resumption of student loan payments this fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know from our guest expert about paying student loans or not paying them, as the case may be? What kind of policy changes would you like to see at the federal level? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Betsy Mayotte, president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors, talking about the Biden administration's new student loan forgiveness plan in the early stages, not taking effect yet, and advice for managing the resumption of student loan repayments. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you dealing with loans yourself? Do you have questions about how this all works? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Betsy, let's go to the front end now. People about to go to college, maybe they're right now. What would you tell them about how to handle debt in those early stages?
Oh, I love that question. So, you know, one of the things I'm seeing with people that are looking on how to pay for college now, and this is a downside, all this talk about forgiveness, is I see people making debt decisions, assuming that their loan forgiveness will be available to them down the road. And, you know, people should never borrow assuming loan forgiveness. So that's number one. Number two, when you're borrowing, especially for your first year, look at how much you need to borrow for that first year, and then multiply it by five and figure out what your student loan payment would be. And is that something you're going to be able to live with? Keeping in mind that you might be making that payment for 10, maybe even 20 or 25 years. And that's going to affect other financial decisions like buying a house or maybe even getting married or having children. The third thing I want to mention is I would love to see people in school getting in the habit of paying at least some, if not all, of the interest as it accrues while they're in school, even though they're not required to. That tip can actually save you a lot of money in the long run.
Let's bring on another caller. Tim is with us in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that have student loans that are from the 2008 crash. There's when I went to MATC, 40, 50, and 60-year-olds outnumbered the younger kids because you couldn't find a job unless you had an associate's degree, and they didn't even care for what, for a $12 an hour job. So there is a whole slew of us from the milk companies, the construction companies that are stuck with debt just because we had no choice if we wanted to live.
Tim, thanks a lot for that call. Betsy, do you see a lot of people concerned, probably in a couple different ways, who got hit? They happened to graduate or be in school right when the Great Recession struck.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this brings up a policy point that I think even a lot of policymakers don't realize. Is that student loan debt is no longer just a quote unquote young person's issue. And a lot of that has to do with what your caller described in the 2008 recession. A lot of what we call non-traditional students went back to school. So today, half of all student loan borrowers are over the age of 30, a quarter are over 45, and the fastest growing age group that has student debt and the group that struggles the most are the over 65s. And a lot of that has to do with the 2008 recession and also the fact that it's taking longer to pay those student loans off.
Thanks for the call, Tim, and good luck to you. Priya joins us now in Chicago. Priya, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
What's your situation, Priya?
So I'm in debt for almost $200K. I have been paying my student loans for maybe 6 or 7 years. I'm on the save plan. I've, done, you know, I think if you reduce your AGI, you can get on the save plan. It's cause it's income based. But I was wondering if you have any advice for me.
Priya, yeah. Thanks for the call. Just a minute or so left, Betsy, for someone in Priya's situation, a younger in their 30s, big load of debt already on the save plan. Any thoughts?
I would look into whether you might qualify or be able to get a job that qualifies for public service loan forgiveness. Otherwise, you know, depending on what your income is, I would stay on the save plan and just make sure that your strategy is the one that's going to cost you the least amount over time. And it sounds like you're headed in that direction already.
Priya, thanks a lot. Good luck dealing with that. Betsy, in our last few moments, again, we started with this Biden administration plan. If I'm hearing you correctly, nobody should look at that and say, oh, I would be eligible for that and base their financial future on it. Wait until it actually happens before planning around it. Do I have that about right?
I could not have said it any better.
Betsy, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Betsy Mayotte, president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors. She talked with us about the Biden administration's new student loan forgiveness plan and the resumption of student loan payments. Still time for you to share your story, your situation, your thoughts, maybe on policy changes. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, remote work led to empty offices in a lot of communities and a big hit to commercial real estate in the country. Find out why that could affect the economy for everybody. And when we have an injury or an illness, a lot of us try to get back into action right away. That's not always for the best. Find out why we should take time to heal with the author of the book, Recovery, The Lost Art of Convalescence. Plus, we'll take a look at a new ethics guideline from the U.S. Supreme Court issued by the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll find out what's in it, what kind of changes it can make, and as always, you can share your thoughts. Let us know your questions right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join those conversations coming up Monday. That's here on Central Time.